and welcome to Through Dangers Untold, a chapter-by-chapter breakdown of the fantasy classic that is Labyrinth. I'm your host, as always, Edward Jones, and joining me, of course, is my co-host and Labyrinth expert extraordinaire, Miss Emily Slade.
Hello!
And we have a special guest tonight, which is always nice. And Emily, do you want to introduce who is joining us here tonight?
Oh my gosh, more than anything. We are joined by the fabulous Vicky Gaskin, who you may know from such endeavours as Gaskin and Healy, or her Shakespeare Stuff in the Park, or her No Small Roles podcast, or her just general amazing vibe of existing. Welcome!
Thanks, Emily! The feeling is mutual. I am so excited to be here today.
Yay, yeah, we're so excited to have you. You are the second guest, but you have such a big segment. Like, I feel this chapter is like what people think of when they think Labyrinth. They're like, yes, David Bowie in that outfit throwing around a baby. Like, that's what Labyrinth is. Like, that's what it is.
It is the essence of Labyrinth, isn't it? I think, like, I was listening to a couple of episodes ago when you were talking about what you picture in your mind's eye when you think of Labyrinth, and I was like, I'm there. I'm both Sarah and Jareth at the same time. Like, that to me, it's like the undiluted squash of Labyrinth, which is why I'm so excited to be here to talk about it. And Labyrinth, any excuse to talk about Labyrinth, yes, is a good day in my book.
Yes. It's always a good day here on Through Dangers Untold. So it's such a great opening to the scene. I'm just going to dive right in. Okay. It's such a great opening to the scene because I'm going to be like, Jennifer's started her journey. Jen is on her way. Sarah has started her journey through the labyrinth, and she looks over at the castle where you can start to hear the like distant like drum of like funk in the distance, and she's like, and also the baby cries, obviously, which are more important to the plot, and she's like, oh, Toby, and then we go over to the goblin castle, but like slap bang in the middle of the city. In the castle we get to see the throne room, which is really interestingly laid out. It's like got a huge fire pit in the middle, which is just filled with goblins. There's like live chickens everywhere, which is like insane. Like, I would have paid money to be on that set with like actors, puppets, chickens, children, David Bowie.
And there's like vultures up the top as well, just sort of like sitting and looking down.
It's amazing.
It's all going on.
There's just so much going on. There's so much to talk about in this room, let alone this scene. I feel like I need to get it in early. Jareth is on his second outfit of the movie out of the six that he wears. And this is arguably the most iconic. So I'm just going to take some time and then I'll shut up to delve into the outfit. And I really hope that you join in.
I would say canon iconic. I'm with you 100% yes, there. This is Jareth as
Jareth. We know him. Dressed this in is his how, finest. If you're going to a festival or a costume party or the pub and you're going to dress up as Jareth the Goblin King, this is what you would choose to wear because this is what would be recognizable. And we've got the open pirate shirt. We've got the beautiful, like, cropped leather waistcoat. We've got the, like, thick, chunky costume jewellery of whatever's going on with that symbol in the middle of his chest that's obviously open from the shirt. Those tight trousers, the, like, riding trousers, with the knee-high heeled boots. Just take a moment of silence to appreciate this outfit, because I didn't when I was 13, because I didn't... You know, this was my sexual awakening, so I didn't really know what I was looking at. And it's only now as an adult that I can really pause each frame to take in the outfit as a whole and appreciate it for what's going on there. Because it's a look. It's a look.
It is. It's an attitude.
Mm, it's a vibe.
It is. I have actually dressed as this version of Jareth before when I was at uni. So this was the exact version that I went for, and it does feel good.
Amazing. You're going to have to send us the photographs of that, obviously. I think I have seen them, but like we just need to post them everywhere all the time again.
Yeah.
It's just iconic. It's every outfit going forward is sort of a variation on this for a while before we get really out there. Elwood, did you have any intense emotional thoughts about the outfit?
About Bowie's labyrinth look? No. Until we started this podcast, I did not realise he changed outfits apart from in the masquerade scene. And I thought, well, obviously that makes sense. He can't just wear his day-to-day clothes when you go to a masquerade. I mean, Sarah's in a fancy dress. He has to look the part as well, and hence why he wears his three-corner hat in that scene. But yes, I mean, here we obviously have Swashbuckler Jarf. And at the same time, it's a Jarf who's very much the king, but he's very much a king of a kingdom of fools, as we look at his court and everyone's an idiot. Which is to be expected because these are goblins. And I think if you're going to employ goblins, then you have to just put up with the fact that you are going to be working with idiots. And I think this is just perfectly captured, just like his workforce is perfectly captured within this scene. You can see there are like the ones which are more like a gorilla suit that stand either side of him, who are like his lieutenants. And then you see the underlings who are basically there dicking around chasing chickens and just generally not being given anything sharp to hold, because you know they're just going to injure themselves. So it's a really great scene, and I think it really, when you look at his outfit, it perfectly suits the sort of setup of what you're going for in this courtroom scene. Because yes, he could have gone for something more regal. He could have had a robe or a crown or something. And now when you mention the jewelry, I wonder if that was like a carryover from like when the original script, where he's has the power to change shape, which we obviously see with him turning into an owl. And at the end, when Sarah defeats him, he would reduce into a snivelling little goblin. And I wondered if that was like something that got left in the script as like the source of his power.
Yeah.
Because it would make sense, because normally if you have some sort of enchantment or power, you have it represented by something. So
some
it would obviously...
totem, yeah.
Yeah. So that would make sense to they would have that, what you call costume jewelry.
Yeah, like an arcane focus.
Yeah. Ooh, look at this.
Someone plays Dungeons and Dragons.
No. I don't play Dungeons and Dragons because in Dungeons and Dragons, a sheep can kill a level one barbarian, which is why...
Oh, no, I meant me.
Which is why I just always used to fill my dungeons with sheep for like my level one players. And it's like, yeah, let's see how you handle this, guys.
Oh. Have you ever been killed by a sheep, Vicky?
I haven't, no.
Your dungeon masters are kinder than Elwood.
He is a kind man.
They just branch out to more exciting things than just filling dungeons of sheep.
Don't give him any ideas, though, because he'll
really
do it.
A really ferocious chicken.
In fact, one of my first encounters was a cockatrice.
Oh, yeah.
And that did nearly get my level one sorcerer, who was very, very squishy. We digress. Let's talk more about Dareth and the wonder that is David Bowie in this scene.
Goodness.
Oh my god.
So I mean, obviously with the setup here, we have a production nightmare, because you look at every one of those puppets. Some of them are going to obviously be suit actors. A lot of them, especially the sitting, are going to be actual puppeteers, so you're looking at least three puppeteers per puppet. And we're looking...
Well, they reckon there's 50 puppets and 10 little people on, like, winches plus the birds, which, like, I think, like, I was watching one of the parts of the documentary and they were saying when everyone was taken out, it looked like Swiss cheese. And they were like, it might fall down. And I think, like, you get that chaos, don't you? Like, 100%. You want to be at that party. Yeah. And, you know, they were just told to be goblins. And it's just, it's genius. It's a director trusting everyone to just do their job and they all... do it. And all of those goblins have their own personalities and their own looks, and even like they even have their own relationship with the camera, which is just like it's just brilliant. Like some of them are like, I'm just gonna sing while I'm crossing shot, and other ones are like looking straight down, and other ones are like singing to someone else, and you're like, there's so much going on.
It's so true. It's so chaotic. It really adds to the like energy of the song as well. You're absolutely right. Every single one looks completely different. And not only do they look different to each other, they look different to any ones that we've seen before. Like we don't zoom in and be like, oh, look, it's the one from the opening where they were like, shush, listen, she's going to say the words. Like none of those are there. These are all completely different goblins, which... it's really, really fun and cool because it shows the expanse of his world and, like, They're all just getting wasted. I love it when like puppets interact with props and they're opening up gallons of like booze and just like guzzling it. But it's a puppet and you're like, someone's gonna have to like towel dry that down afterwards and then put it back for the shot. Oh my God. And we are introduced to the majestic Jareth as he is like lounging on his throne with his like stick, and he's like deep in thought and he's looking at the clock and it's just so gorgeous. Like there's really, all I'm going to say is how beautiful David Bowie is in this scene. Really. That's my notes for David Bowie.
And he just is. And then you are like, you take a step back and you're like, it was him and a baby and people in suits and puppets and birds. Like you sort of take a step back and go like, he must have felt like, what am I doing? But he just owns it and just, yeah, like skips around them all. Oh, it's just
literally, he easily just an amazing, could have got amazing so scene. Lost. Like a human actor amongst all of those puppets could have gotten so lost. But Jim Henson and the Hensons and that company are so apt at casting people that can like hold their own amongst dead-eyed creatures, essentially. Like Michael Caine has the same energy, Tim Curry has the same energy in all of the main movies, like, and David Bowie fucking kicks them out of the room in Magic Dance. Like he literally is kicking goblins out of the room and he's kicking every other actor that's acted alongside goblins out of the room because he's bringing 110% energy over these fantastic actors that are doing these puppets. And it's just so iconic.
And with like a complex relationship with them. And you've got that moment where he's like got his head in his hands. And David Bowie was like, you know, his description of Jareth was like, these goblins have stolen the baby. And Jareth just would probably rather just be down Soho. And you like, you get that. And then you get him like jumping in with the goblins. I'm like, well, you know, I'm here. And he sort of like has a bit of fun with them. And you see him, you know, well, and then you see him with the baby and you're like, oh, that's actually quite sweet. Then he chucks it in the air and then he does the wonderful dancing. Oh, it's God. He just does so much. I think it's one of the like the peaks of the film where you're like, you know, Michael Jackson or Sting or anyone else that they thought of like could never have pulled that off. Like,
absolutely not.
It's why he's so perfect, isn't it?
And he steals it, and it's why the movie has lasted so long, because everybody remembers this scene. Everybody knows this is Labyrinth, and it's because it's David Bowie giving 1,000,000%, doing 1,000,000 different things, bringing so much to one small moment that doesn't even arguably make any sense within the context. Like, don't get me wrong, we will talk about the song, and it's a brilliant song. It's one of the best. Everybody knows it, but it doesn't progress the plot. It doesn't make sense.
It barely makes sense within it. I was like, oh my God, I love this song. And I was like, they're definitely going to talk about the lyrics, so let's like have a deep dive into these lyrics. And I was like, I am arguably more confused for trying to make sense. And then reading someone's interpretation of exactly what is going on here. And I was like, do you know what? I'm going to just go back to the version of this song where I just want to dance to it and...
It's a bop. And I think he released it as a single in his own right, too. So you could argue that, like, the baby that you're thinking within the context of the movie is Toby is now your, like, teenage girlfriend. And so it kind of works, I guess.
Yeah. But apparently, though, through all these things I was, like, diving into, apparently, like, a lot of Bowie fans were like, what has he done? Little did they know we were all there going, we love you.
I think at this time Bowie's very much the Thin White Duke before he becomes Jareth. So he's got the iconic blonde hair, he's got the powder blue suits, and it's ironic they're saying, what have you done, when he's at this point he's still doing like Scary Monster Super Freaks, and it's sort of like only gets weirder from here. It doesn't get any more sane. We're not going back to Major Tom here.
No, he's not calming down.
No, as my favorite quote about Bowie said is like, he's still the alien, but at least he wants to talk to us now.
Lovely.
And I mean, there's a thing with Bowie, he never took anything too seriously. it was always just like the particular artistic moment he was in, and he was in that fortunate stage where he got to the point where he could just basically go off and do what he wanted. I mean, prior to this, he had done The Laughing Gnome, which is his, also his justification for doing the baby gurgles in this film.
Yeah.
Because as he put it, that we spent about a good hour trying, you know, kicking and punching and trying to get this baby to gurgle, and it just wasn't happening. And I thought, well, I did the Laughing Gnome record, so I can do this as well. So
I do love that. It's another reason why he's so wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's funny you would like talking about his movements in here. And it's clearly he's been given a limited amount of space that he can move. So his movements are very awkward. And you can see that. I also assume that this was early in the filming because he uses his, I don't want to say nightstick, but that's not the word. It's his cane as a microphone. If you look at the way he holds it, he's holding it like a microphone. So in his head, the way to get through this is I do it as a performance. And this is why we're breaking the third wall, the fourth wall here. And we're stopping the film so we can have this performance by Bowie. And because we're obviously, it being Bowie, it's like, this isn't a bad thing to have a Bowie performance. So we don't mind the fact that we're breaking the fourth wall to have this moment. And it works all the better for the film because it's the only way to shoot a scene so complex. And I mean, only Joe Dante does scenes this complex with puppets. When you look at like look at Gremlins, and you look at the cinema scene and the bar scene, they're the only sort of scenes I can think of that involve puppetry, or even like in the fantasy sort of realm that go this sort of complex. If you look at like Lord of the Rings, there is no scene as complex as the ones that we're seeing in this film. They're all very much like little blocks of things, and we're seeing like big sweeping randoms, but it's like four or five characters, but they're multiplied by computer, so everyone's very uniform. In this, we've got characters doing what the hell they want. There's things happening in the background, like there's a chicken escaping up a vent and there's a goblin putting a net over it. You've got another one with like...
Like you could take any of the interactions, couldn't you, and make like your own mini like story out of them. And like how, like, yeah.
And the fact that we mentioned already, the fact that all these characters have so much life, which is obviously a real big Henson trait, the fact that we're not looking at these as puppets, that these are living, breathing sort of creatures. And I think by giving them such individual personalities, like the one that shoots the chicken with a pea shooter and it just amuses them all. And it's like, well, yeah, that's what goblins would do. They're not like going to be sitting there going, right, we're going to prepare for when she goes and storms the goblin city. I mean, she rocks up on the city later in the film and they're like, oh, wait a minute, she's here now. And it's like this mass panic. So
it's interesting you mentioned about breaking the fourth wall. Like, it doesn't really happen that I can think of anywhere else in the movie except during the song sequences where our villain and... arguably romantic lead just stares directly into the camera and like talks to us. My notes here is look into the camera more, Bowie, stare into my soul, because it's just enjoyable. But it's really interesting,
but it also brings us in with Jareth. Doesn't it? I think, like, so I don't remember a time in my life where I didn't know Labyrinth, so I came to it very young, and I didn't have the Jared sexual awakening until I was, you know, quite old. But I always felt like he's not like a baddie. Yeah. Like he's like, and I think there's like, it's this scene, it's him breaking the fourth wall that make you be like, oh, I can see it from Jared's point of view here. And I mean, I have some very specific ideas on what is going on in Labyrinth, but... It sort of really gets you, it makes it, yeah, you can be a bit more on Jareth's side, can't you? Even though he has basically stolen her baby brother.
He's a Loki-style villain. He's about mischief. He's not like Thanos, who cares about domination and destruction. Everything he's doing is basically to try and screw with Sarah. I mean, you look at like all the things she's going to go with. All his little minions are just designed just basically to screw with her in one way or another. And as the song's going on, we're cutting back and forth to Sarah, who's using a lipstick to make the marks, and we have the little goblins who are just moving everything around.
So are they goblins? Because I always took them as like I don't see everything in the labyrinth being a goblin. Like, if you live in the goblin city, in my head, you are a goblin. And maybe this is me being racist for the cultures of the labyrinth. But if you live in the goblin city, you're a goblin. Mm. But then there are other creatures and races that exist within the labyrinth. And we mentioned on the outskirts how you really feel that everything's alive and brimming and everything lives in the labyrinth. And it's sort of reconfirmed here where little... I thought they were like little trolls or something, like just another different type of species that pop out of the ground and deliver. We know that the best line in Labyrinth is, come on, feet. But the second best line in Labyrinth is, your mother is a fracking aardvark. That's the greatest.
Which I misheard until I put the subtitles on quite badly.
What did you miss when you said?
I thought he said, your mother is a fucking cunt. And then this was before streaming, and put the subtitles on the DVD and was like, you know, when you're like, that can't have been hidden in a children's movie. And it obviously hadn't. But I was like, that,
you were like, wow,
very
Jim
close
Henson.
To what it sounds like he's saying. Yeah.
There's numerous things. I mean, they obviously, I'm just using Goblin just because it's my go-to thing. And I think it's because we were talking about Terry Pratchett's Discworld before we came on the air. So goblins are very much in my head. So. When you think in the Discworld, goblins are just small and they run speed cameras and all anything technology related is usually a goblin crammed in a box. But obviously, if we're looking at this from more sort of like, you know, fancy edge, they could be like pixies, they could be imps.
Imps is how I always think of them, as this like a sort of like imps that live underneath and like that's their domain and that's sort of what they do. And they've got a slightly different vibe, I think, certainly to the goblins we see in Magic Dance, who are just like having a party, not really giving a shit. Whereas the ones underneath the paving slabs are very highly strung.
And they're organised.
Yeah.
And they like work together and they're very particular. Like, and you get that just from the simplest, tiniest moments with them, because we never once sort of delve underground. We never have a moment where we peep through and see what they're doing. They just come up to the surface, deal with the problems that have arisen in their little world, and then return again. And we're moving on with Sarah. We've already like 3 steps ahead of them, which again is just so lovely, because it just feels like it's brimming with life and magic, and I love it so much. And their little outfits are just really fun. And again, they're very different to what the goblins... The goblins have this sort of armor over in the Goblin City, whereas these people feel more sort of medieval in their dress. It looks sort of jestery from my, like, brief memory of them appearing and disappearing. Love that Sarah's using her lipstick. Like, do we want to jump into that thematically with the older... So Vicky, I'm sure you're aware, we're having an ongoing debate where I'm insistent that the events of Labyrinth genuinely happened.
You say one thing and then it just hangs with you forevermore.
So
else.
I think I have proof that you are right, Emily. I've been thinking about this. There is a tiny chink in the armour, but I mean I've been obsessed with this podcast since you started it. I rewatched it this week, sort of just to sort of, because it's always good to watch Labyrinth. And I think it all rests. I think it all rests on the owl in the opening scene, right? So the owl lands on that sort of funny little rock column. And she runs around the corner and starts delivering her speech. I don't think she delivers the speech to the owl. So we can assume in that opening scene that Sarah hasn't noticed the owl. Mm-hmm. That's how I read it anyway. So in my head, she's talking to herself / us in the camera and or Merlin. And then obviously, then she runs away. So she hasn't seen the owl in the opening. So that owl doesn't exist in her imagination. That owl is there. Mm-hmm. And then when the owl appears and turns into Jareth, like that existed before she perceived it.
That's the continuity of reality happening there. I agree. So, beautiful.
So I am well on side with you there, Emily.
Yes.
But I also have another theory about Jareth and the owl, which is a massive segue that I don't have to share
Please
with you now.
Share it
but
with us
I
am. Right
it all hangs on her mum's boyfriend, who sidecar. When I first watched Labyrinth when I was younger. It was the time when there was one telly in the house with one video player, and so I couldn't watch Labyrinth much. So I, on floppy disk, when I was about 12-ish, took the floppy disk to my IT teacher and asked if I could print out the novelization of Labyrinth on PDF, which he had no idea what was going to happen. Like, he had no idea how big it was going to be. So for me, the film and the novelization run, they are sort of one and the same, and sometimes I have to sort of pick it apart. And it turns out they've republished the novelization this year, so I'm now digging back in. But in that, they talk a lot about her mum, Linda, and Jeremy, and the fact that they're performers, and the fact that they've got this very romantic relationship that you read as an adult, who is, I'm also an actor, being like, is it as, like, is this as good as she maybe sort of sees it? And so I have a theory that I don't know if I definitely, like, I'm 100% on board, but I was like, I'll pitch it to you and see how you feel. Okay. That Jareth isn't David Bowie. Jareth is the owl, right? Who comes and is there to basically teach Sarah to, like, understand the new family dynamic with which she's living in. So he appears to her in the form of Jeremy, who she's got a borderline crush on, her mum's boyfriend, and sort of, I guess, like, yeah, he, like, he looks like Jeremy, and is, like, sort of the bad guy.
Yeah.
And then, as I was really going down this rabbit hole, I was like, well, then the sort of the and it's sort of almost this, like, he is the baddie, but he's got her best interest at heart, and she needs to learn this lesson to be able to really love her little brother. And and obviously in the novelization, the ending is a bit different to what we see in the film. And that Hoggle, I wrote this down because I knew I'd forget it. Hoggle stands for selfishness, which becomes loyalty. Ludo stands for stupidity, which becomes kindness. And Didymus stands for obnoxiousness, that becomes bravery. So it's all the things that her baby brother, like, annoys her about her baby brother, that he's selfish, that he's obnoxious, that he's stupid because he's a baby. Mm-hmm. But, like, she really, like, helps those characters in as much as they help her, yes, to be able to maybe, like, appreciate the contrast in those qualities. And so by the end, in the end of the novelization, spoiler alert if you haven't read it, like, she puts all the pictures away, she puts the music box away, and she she has a conversation with her stepmother as well. And she says, I think she calls up the stairs, the stepmother, and Sarah's like, just give me a minute, I'm just closing a chapter in my life. And so
deep.
I was like,
all right, so.
Yeah, like that's sort of another reading of it.
That's really great.
Most people that's amazing. Don't give a shit about.
That's like, yes, I'm totally on board with the, like, juxtaposition of those, like, traits appearing in those characters. Love that idea, because we'd noted that obviously her mum's boyfriend looks like David Bowie, is David Bowie in the mirror. But then for Jareth to exist separately to that and choose it as a form... that's amazing. I'm totally on board with that.
Like I say, there are lots of holes in that theory, and I'm not completely on but board. But I was like, if anyone will understand, it'll be you.
No, I love it. I love it a lot.
But basically, what it stems down to is, it's real.
It's real.
It's real. And I also very much subscribe to the Richard Parker Life of Pi attitude of, like, does it really matter whether it's in her imagination or real anyway? If she believes that it's real,
therefore it's real. 100%. I agree. And like yeah,
sorry, Elwood.
It's fine. That's the thing. It's not something I was, like, nailing anything on particularly.
No, but I've made it as such. I've been like, you gotta stick to your guns now, sir.
You really have
26 episodes. He's like, I just thought it'd be interesting to bring, and I'm like, no!
I just was posing another point of view.
We're doing this now. Yeah, so she uses her lipstick, which is very resourceful and a great prop, mm-hmm, that she then throws away, and then it appears later, which everyone seems to have a problem with because they always have a problem with that kind of thing in movies. But I don't care. The lipstick is also always seen as a symbol of, like, adulthood, because As we all know, women used to put red lipstick on their lips to imitate the vagina to attract the man.
Is that where lipstick comes from?
Yeah, and Tim Minchin says it in a song where he's like, I don't know, I can't quote it, I'm paraphrasing, but it's basically like the lipstick lips were meant to imitate the lips of a vagina, and that's what that's all about.
Wow. That is
because
real.
The patriarchy is everywhere. And so much like the red
But as
hood.
You say, Emily, she is using that symbol to be like really resourceful.
Exactly.
And
smart. Like it's Hansel and Gretel when they used stones, not bread, because they learnt from their mistakes. Like it's that. It's like really smart thinking, which then, of course, is wonderful that the labyrinth itself is like, no. You're going to get lost. So she's on it. She's fine. I hold children like Bowie does. Like, I've realised, like, he holds that child in such an awkward manner. And I'm like, it's me when someone hands me a live baby. It's like he doesn't quite know what to do with it. And then it turns plastic and he throws it in the air. And then it turns live again as a goblin catches it. It's, I don't know whose decision it was to make him throw Toby in the air. I'm glad they did it. Bit odd, though.
I feel like if I'm given a small child, I will, I mean, not to that level, but I'm a bit of a, like, swing a kid in the air, like, hold their hand and swing them round. Let's go to the edge of the platform. I know they're safe, but the parent freaks out. Like, I feel like it's probably one of the things that just I've got from Labyrinth.
Yeah, yeah. That's how childcare is. Okay, noted.
The Jared School of looking after people's children.
Elwood, you've talked a lot about how when Toby cries, your sort of like parent instincts kick in. Does the same thing happen when he's thrown in the air?
No. When he's thrown in the air, I mean, as I said, because you do stupid things with your own children. This is the thing, when you have children, you realise that they are not made out of glass, as you are told, and that they do bounce, and usually can catch them on the first bounce, and you're fine. The fact is that kids, no matter what you do, they will find some way to injure or maim themselves. It's just child nature. It's what evolution's there for. You know, they do these things to learn not to do them. It's like, yes, if I run into the table, this will happen. And hence why you pad these things out, because, you know, you can only, you don't want your child being dinged up, do you? Because people ask questions. But no, as I said, obviously this is Brian Froud's son here. I have to say he's a better animator than he is an actor. Because this baby just has no clue what's going on whatsoever. I don't think any of the animators
fair
knew what
play
they were doing.
To him though. Yeah. Like, if you're a baby surrounded by that in real life, like,
he does a good job of getting those shots where he is like giggling and responding to Jareth. Because in the sort of long shots where you're meant to be looking at David Bowie dancing, I found myself looking at Toby this time, and he's being held by two actors in the goblin suits, and he is not a happy bunny. He is so upset and afraid, which, again, I would be if you threw me in a room full of like towering actors in disgusting, grotesque monster suits. I would be like, parents, why do you hate me? And chances are one of them was his parent in the suit, but regardless, I'd be like, the whole time, which is what he is. So again, I hope he got a good paycheck. He probably didn't, because he was a baby. Do you think he got paid? Or were his parents like, we've got a baby, we could just use him?
Yeah,
like,
pretty
was
much.
Was it that?
Yeah. It's Brian Froud's son, isn't it?
That's who he based based Toby off when they were doing like the design sketches, so it kind of made sense that they would just bring in the real Toby when they actually needed a baby. And so, as I said, it's just easier to work with a child that belongs to someone on set than to draft in an actor baby, because then you've got to, it's another person you've got to deal with, Whereas if you're part of the crew, you're sort of like, yeah, you can totally work 14-hour days.
Yeah. Yeah. Knowing the parent is half the battle. Like I have been teaching drama to kids for a long time. Kids never a problem. It's the parents that come with, not every parent,
yeah, of course,
only the occasional one, but it's the parents that come with the problems. Mm-hmm. So if you know the parent, you're like halfway there, aren't you?
Yeah, perfect.
I think the parents that teach their children that the Disney style of acting is acceptable are also a problem in life. Just that you have to overact everything and everything's this big dramatic performance, and it's like, just calm your ass down. have a miniature hero or something. Just stop.
Have a miniature hero.
You need to go around kicking chairs over and things. I don't know. I just don't know how people work with these child actors who just see what they watch on the Disney Channel. And this is why I appreciate like 80s kids stuff, the stuff we like grew up with, because the children were freaking restrained and they weren't all smart asses, and that they reacted in ways that children would. Though.
Like, there was always this smart ass in the group, often played by Corey Feldman.
But at the
same
time,
there was always that one that was like,
But they were like child smart. They weren't like mini adult smart, which a lot of
they were my least favorite kid. The like smart ass kid that also like bullies all the other kids. I'm always like, shut up. You suck.
No one cares about your story.
Yeah. You don't have a story. You don't belong here. You're not a misfit. You're just loud. But yeah, luckily Labyrinth doesn't have that. Just a teenager and a baby. But yeah, poor little Toby. Not having a good time in the realm of the Goblin King, which is valid.
No.
But yeah, the song itself, what a bop. What an absolute bop. And people probably know it a lot. They especially will know that You Remind Me of the Babe, which is a song before that they slightly rehashed. You can find that song in the 2002 live-action Scooby-Doo movie, one of the greatest movies ever made. And I think it was in a film before then, but it's not as important.
Well, the opening is based on a Cary Grant Shirley Temple skit. Isn't it?
Yeah.
Which I did not realise till today. It's like, oh, hello, black and white film.
Yeah.
And this has all been taken from.
And I always thought it was like a little nursery rhyme type thing, that because I knew it sort of pre-existed, that it wasn't made for Labyrinth, but I always assumed it was that one of those sort of like, I don't know, like old back and forth nursery rhymes that kids say, but no, you're right, it's from like a 1940s thing, and then I think it's been rehashed
about a much older man and a much younger woman, awkwardly.
Interesting. Do you think that's do you think that was part of the decision, or do you think they were like, a bop, let's include it in our bop?
It's a bop. I'm gonna choose to believe that, because it's a much nicer decision.
Because otherwise then you have to start having the conversations about, did the production team make explicit choices about the love aspect of, in fact, Vicky, while we've got you here, and like, I'm pretty sure this is not going to be your last appearance on this podcast, but I want to hear your thoughts now anyway.
Please. Yes.
Is it romantic? Is it a love match? Is it that?
For me, it isn't. But I think, like I was saying, like I was trying to work out when I first saw Labyrinth, and I definitely had my sisters are 2 and 4 years younger than me, and I took being an older sister very seriously. So I remember, like, in the first instances of watching it, being like, if my sister went missing, it would be the worst thing in the world. So I was definitely older than 4, but I was definitely younger than 6, because I remember making a pie chart on the gateway computer of the school when we were learning it, and you had to have your favourite films. And everyone loved The Little Mermaid. So, like, it was a big chunk, and I had to decide the films, and it was whatever everyone else was watching. And then it was Labyrinth and Dark Crystal. No, it was Labyrinth and Return to Oz were the two films, because it was all, like, the films that I enjoyed. And I remember that I was the only vote for Labyrinth. And there was one little boy that wasn't allowed to watch films. And so the teacher was like, we'll put you in for Return to Oz. And I remember that was the moment I was like, oh, you know, when you're a kid and you're like, everyone clearly loves this movie. So Yeah, I've sort of like, I must have been six by the time I already loved this film. So I think because I was so young and I would, it was like always on telly around Christmas, probably, yeah. Like in the late 80s, early 90s. I think I was just like, it was very innocent and I wouldn't have ever understood any of that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, then as I got older and became a teenager. Also, there was a friend of mine when I was that age and her mum looked so much like Jareth. Like, it was, you know, end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s. She had this full-on mullet. She would do a lot of that, like, power, silver makeup. And, like, I remember being like, if I stay over her house, like, what is going to happen? Like... And we were those friends that did sleep over. So I think like that was my like formative time of Labyrinth. Amazing. Was just being like, is this lady going to turn into Jareth in the middle of the night and go steal my sisters and take them to the goblins? Because that would be awful, but also be awesome. Yeah. And then, yeah, as I got older, I mean, who doesn't fancy David Bowie in this film at some point, who is into men, because he's just... beautiful and gorgeous and so much fun. But I think I kind of don't get the love story. Mm. And I think as well, like, yeah, it's, I think because of the sort of my relationship with the novelization and sort of seeing Jareth a bit as her mum's boyfriend, I think that all that never really connected.
Yeah. No, I love that. Yeah. I love that as an answer.
So that's where I stand.
Yeah.
We've got another piece, another novelisation for you to read if you want to talk about the romance angle, certainly.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. We've got a really great one that we've dug up, which is essentially if the film ending would be different.
Elwood keeps finding fanfics and emailing them to me. And I'm like, no.
I'll tell you what, Elwood, send it to me on a floppy disk and I'll get my year 9 IT teacher to print it out PDF for me and I'll really enjoy it.
I'm so glad to hear that someone else has done that, because I did that with the original Legend script. I like printed it out.
Oh, amazing.
Put it in like a Polly Pocket and was like, this is what cool people do, right? Like, this is normal.
Absolutely,
and now I know that is
only the coolest.
No, that's really cool. I, like, obviously, as you know, came to this movie at 13, which is possibly the worst time to come to it in terms of, like, having a healthy relationship with it and its characters. Mm. Much like, you know, and I'd grown up on a diet of, like, Thumbelina as well. So I was already very skewed in what was good and what was not good in terms of relationships and romances, especially within the context of a movie. So this was just the beautiful, shiny cherry on a very problematic cake that I had been feasting on throughout the 90s. But no, I'm really glad that it is very obviously he is the bad guy. But much like a Disney villain, he is fun and you are meant to enjoy the time that you spend with him. But be happy when the hero triumphs and not like,
yeah,
oh, you should stay. You should stay in the labyrinth. You should get married. You guys should kiss. Because that's wrong.
Yeah, it's all great thinking, I'll stay in the labyrinth, but if you looked around what's available in the labyrinth, it's not exactly got all your mod cons. You are living a medieval existence.
Pestilence so it's and disease like going to fucking rife. Hogwarts.
Yeah.
I'd hate that. I'd be like, what do you mean I have to write with a quill? Like, that's going to be fun for like a day max.
Yeah.
Then I want to be writing my essays at least with a biro, if not on Microsoft Word. Like, are you kidding me, Dumbledore? Not fucking topping up on ink.
Yeah, you're dealing with a world where a dwarf is peeing in the water supply. So
very true. Just little sound bites from this movie as well. At the very beginning of this scene, David Bowie has some great ones. He does some really great, like, scratchy stuff with his voice as Jareth. I don't know if he does it in any other movies that he's appeared in, but it's very notable for me for Jareth. Like, at the very beginning, he's like, quiet! And then he, like, laughs, and they don't laugh. So to get them to laugh, he goes, well? And he has that, like, scratchy, that yeah. weird tone, and I'm always like, nice, I like it. Sorry, Elwood, I thought I'd interrupted you, so I was waiting for you to
pick up the combo again. As I said, I've got no cryptozoology for this week, so I'm just pointing out the flaws in this medieval society that people are so keen to live in, but it's sort of like, just face any day-to-day situation and ask how it would be handled in the labyrinth, and the whole world just falls apart like the end of the film.
Yeah, I mean, given a choice, where would you set up base? Like, you don't. If you wanted a house, you'd have to go to the Goblin City. Otherwise, it's like a tent in the garden maze or a... Actually...
The Goblin City does not feel like a good place to live.
No, I think your neighbor... There's not really a community vibe, and everyone's sort of military. Mm. And that's nothing against sort of military segments of communities, but this military in particular feels very old-fashioned. You could go and live in Sarah's room that's situated in the junkyard, but the ceilings could fall in at any point if you like stop believing or whatever.
And you have to deal with a woman coming in all the time.
And, like, you'd open the door and
woman splaining your room to you. That's not a thing. But, you know, junk lady explaining, like, oh,
you like your panda slippers.
Yeah, I know.
You know how much you love your panda slippers.
You don't have to tell me, junk lady. Yeah,
You can actually do
that. I mean, like, I could shrink myself down and go live with the worms.
Oh my god, 100%. And like in the manga, Return to Labyrinth, you get an insight into their home, and it's as cozy and as snug as you expect.
I've not read it, but it's inspired by you to
do. And
especially if you get to see the worms.
100%. They're so cozy and warm, and they're like there together and having living their best life. You know.
Yeah.
Just what you expect.
I wouldn't mind, like, just following Didymus around the labyrinth. I could be in his entourage. I do love Sir Didymus.
Assuming that he left his post at the bog, because I don't want to be there.
I wouldn't live on the bog.
The air is fresh and fragrant.
The air is fresh and fragrant. And that shall pass without my permission. It's like one of the best lines in the whole film. Just love him.
I suppose the gardens would be nice, but there's nowhere to really live. You can live in the caverns, which it seems where Hoggle lives, because he's got his magic door. You assume that that's where he spends most of his time, and he is a dwarf, so it is underground. No, the options are limited and few. I mean, if you live in Jareth's castle, you've got to deal with all that crazy architecture.
Oh my god, like you'd be like running to the bathroom and you'd end up in the Escher room and you'd be like, fuck!
I mean, if you ever try getting a couch of a spiral staircase...
20 minutes.
Yeah.
And you think that's bad. I mean, you just try getting it up an Escher staircase. So
literally, I'd be like, now I'm upside down. I just need to go to the fucking bathroom, Jareth. Why couldn't you have made like a corridor?
You can't even like go in the Escher room, because what way is the flow going to go? Like, you just open yourself up to a myriad of problems.
Exactly. Someone else comes in at the other end thinking they're safe. Next thing they know.
Yeah.
Just awful. Just clearly... designed for him to live alone, so he can just pitch himself in the throne room and only visit his other rooms if he feels like it. But for anyone else, you're like, well, where am I staying? Where's the bathroom? Like,
I think also, like, your life what's it called, prospects are very
not many jobs going, unless you want to do like Jareth's bidding, which I don't think pays very well.
No. Or it doesn't seem like a very, like, outside of just, like, hanging out and dancing around, it's just sort of, like, stopping people getting through.
And you can't really...
fighting in the
there's
city.
There's no, like, career progression, because you're not going to be able to make your way up to king eventually, because we assume he's going to hold that spot forever, like a fucking boomer refusing to retire.
Exactly that.
He's just going to sit on that goblin throne, and you're like, well, I've made it to general of the military. How can I progress my career? I've got a wife and two goblins at home. And he's like, I can't help you.
Someone's designing his outfits, though. That wouldn't be the worst job in the labyrinth,
would it? That's very true. Although I imagine he's very, like, picky and there'd be a lot of consequences if you got something slightly wrong or tried him out with like a hot pink and he's like, clearly my vibe is like neutral tones. Yeah. And you'd be like, I'm sorry, I just thought, you know, you don't go anywhere. So it's like lockdown every day here in the castle. You just turn into an owl every now and then and bugger off, but we have to stay here, so just trying to liven the place up a bit. Yeah, it'd be pretty miserable, actually, to live under Jareth's reign. And he doesn't seem particularly cruel, just careless, and sometimes that's worse.
I'm going to just go off and live in legend instead.
Oh my god, 100%.
I think, and there's many places I can live. I can live in the woods, or in a cottage, or I can go and live with Nell's darkness. Cottage. Who even has like his own kitchen set up and stuff, so.
Yeah, he's got chefs. He's got live-in chefs.
Yeah.
Like, he's living his best life. Yeah, sure, he's in like a swamp in a tree, but like, hey, potato patata. I don't know that that makes sense. But yeah, I mean, other than like general vibes, I've run out of notes. It's just such a great scene. There's so much going on. We get a really good progression of Sarah's journey whilst also having a really great almost reintroduction, because we've met Jareth as like the villain and perpetrator of our piece. And now it's like, hey, here he is as like a character. And like, here's like the Goblin City. And like, look, Toby's safe. And like, it's just really good. Like, I think the songs are necessary. Like, I think they're good. That's what the Dark Crystal was missing. More song and dance numbers.
Yeah, I had never thought of that. I agree. Yeah, for sure.
Because it's quite slow. Love the Dark Crystal, don't get me wrong. But Sting could have just walked in at one point.
It's a different vibe.
Very different vibe. Very different vibe. But still great.
The courtroom scene, again, reminds me well of the Goblins so much, because we get moments with them just doing simple things, like saying things like thunder and lightning or slugs and snails, that charm me in the same way that when they're introduced and it's like, did you say it? It's like, that's not the word. And it's those simple things.
Yeah.
Also, when Bowie says, goes to the slugs and snails bit, he holds his nose because that's the best way to represent slime. He presses his hand to the side of his nose to do that, that thing, if you need to clear your nose and you don't have a handkerchief. And you're with...
Oh, what, like a...
Yes, here you go.
Kind of thing.
This is why we don't use cams and all. It makes your hand, when you're doing your own little hand puppet theatre, a lot easier.
And much like some of the best Disney songs, all of those little tidbits within... are always really fun to like do. You know, it's like Belle's song at the opening of Beauty and the Beast. You're like singing along to the music and then you can stop to be like, slime and snails.
A puppy dog tails.
So good.
But yeah, it's just fun. If you just pick a character in that courtroom just to follow. Every time, because the problem is with Bowie's performance, it's everything's focused on him as a center, which is great from a puppeteer's perspective because you're trying to do complex puppeteering things, you know, all the technical terms tonight. And if you've got someone to distract it, you haven't got someone going, oh, well, that puppet didn't move his mouth in the right thing. It gives you a bit of leeway. And I think that's what the great thing about having Bowie being designed so he is always the center of the attention, always shot in the center, and then we have these little offshoots which are like fun little snapshots. But when you go
there's no time to pick the holes in what's going
on. There's so much happening,
just see them and enjoy
and
them.
I think this is one of the most rewarding scenes of the film, is just like how much stuff is going on there. And then you think, oh, well, that was a really technical shot, and then we get onto the fireys and you realise that that's shot completely on a black screen that has to be kept perfectly clean, because which is no good when you've got so much glitter flying around the film. Just to do this, do these, have multiple puppeteers again in black suits moving things around, so it's magical. But
like,
yeah, the fiery
dance
is
so wonderful because like Labyrinth really gives that impression that they're all at like university. and they've been given a budget and a deadline, and they're all just spending their time being like, what should we like try next? Like, what should we do? How about if we did this? And it just feels like so much stuff was invented on the fly or on the spot, or like they'd come up with an idea in the morning and be like, can you go away and workshop this for like 2 hours and then come back and we'll see what your ideas are. And, you know, they talk about putting the helping hands together and then coming up with the fireys tearing apart.
The helping hands are just genius.
I think I ruined my own hands not realizing it was multiple hands. Like when you're a kid, and you're like, you break your finger because you want to put that finger in between there to create the pupil.
And it's like, when you're a kid, it's fine.
But when you're an adult, you really realize that perhaps you shouldn't be doing that.
And it just feels like a bunch of mates having a really good time coming up with different stuff that they then get to like perform. And it just so happened to be for a movie that was then sent to cinemas. And that's why I really love it. It's a passion project through and through, of a million different artists coming together and just giving us some great stuff. And this scene is...
And it's really theatrical as well. I think the joy of it is, as someone who I love theatre, I love movies, and it just feels like almost like a celebration of life.
Yes.
And I remember when I was like... real like angsty like tween, being like, I'm gonna grow up and be a famous performer, being like, you know, this is when I'll play Sarah in the like theatrical version in the theater of Labyrinth.
Yes.
you can go there, can't 100%. You of being like, oh my god. And 100%.
Emily does on a weekly basis,
every single week.
come on people turn up for this. That's why I was just waiting. Every time she set off, I was just like, Do the line.
Play
your ding dong. Say, come on, feet.
That's me. But yeah, and then the dream of that is to be on Graham Norton one day, and Graham Norton's like, would you like to say the line from Labyrinth? And I'll be like, oh, Graham, with pleasure.
Oh, Graham Norton.
So many people.
Another reason why I love you, Emily, is that he is a... legend.
I just like, that's the pinnacle. Like, screw the BAFTAs. Like, I didn't mean that BAFTA.
Did that themselves.
Feel free to give me an award.
Yeah, but who really wants a BAFTA?
No, I hear you, Emily. Sitting on that Graham Norton couch is like, I have made it in this industry.
And you never know who 100%. You're going to be sat next to. So, like, some days I'm sat next to Meryl Streep. Other days I'm sat next to, like, some pop star who I don't know. And I have a really fun, embarrassing conversation where I'm like, I'm so sorry. I don't know who you are. I'm so out of touch. Oh, honestly. Yeah. Do you know who he is, Meryl? Yeah.
I'm always the one on the end who's the like British funny one, and so they're all A-listers nearer Graham Norton, and I'm like on the end being like, insert joke here. I'm just lucky to be here.
Definitely. And then like the music star comes and like squeezes up next to you if they're like valid for the couch time. 100%. Yeah. And like if Ed Sheeran came on, I'd be like, fun fact, Ed, you once met my sister at Ipswich Music Festival. And he'll be like, cool.
Ooh.
And Graham will be like, oh, do tell. And I'll be like, well, that was the story. that was the extent of it. But
Graham would know, though. Graham would know.
Someone
he'd
would
be
have,
like ready
dug
for
dug around
it,
and be like, we've actually got a picture of you, Ed, back in 2007. Oh, yeah. Many more daydreams about what I'm talking about on the Graham Norton couch than I've figured out what I'm going to say for my acceptance speech for my BAFTA.
I'm there with you. For sure.
Yeah, that's the, like, peak. And if you're a returning guest as well, like, if I get Mark Ruffalo is always on that couch, and I would love to just, like, chill out with the Hulk and just be like, Mark, you're really cool. You're welcome.
Or get to Miriam Margolyes standards
A queen. A queen.
Queen.
In her court, reigning over. Graham, you come sit here. Miriam, take the chair. Please.
I just want to ask Marcel Ruffalo how he feels about being the third best Hulk. He is no Edward Norton. Edward Norton knew what that role was. And
yeah,
you see,
but Edward Norton's a twat.
I don't care if he's a twat. I don't care what you have to go through to get the role. I am here as consumer. I'm not here as a thing. When you look at Mark Ruffalo, he's just happy to be there. So he's happy. He's constantly the whipping boy. And you're thinking, are you really, like, just constantly want to be poking the atom bomb? So that's, I never bought Ruffalo as the Hulk. But as I said, the lineage of Hulks goes, you know, Freeno, Norton, and then miscellaneous.
Wow. That's just rude.
Wow.
I would stop you. If I was there with you, I'd be like, I'd strip or something just to distract the attention away. So it's like, don't you dare come for Mark Ruffalo on my watch. Not while I'm here to defend him. I've not seen any other Hulks, but I know you're wrong.
I have forgotten Ed Norton's entire performance as the Hulk that has been blindsided
so
by
Disney.
Mark Ruffalo. But I say that, not, I'm not like a massive Marvel person. I'm just like, who?
Thank you so much for coming on. What a pleasure.
Thank you for having
what
me.
What a joy. It's eyes open, brains opened, full of new thoughts and ideas. Gonna go buy the novelization now. Tell us everything about yourself right now in detail.
Okay. She takes a breath. Yeah, I was born in 1985. No. I'm a bit of a jack of all trades, master of none. I am writing comedy with Gaskin and Healy. You can follow us across the social medias at Gaskin and Healy. New stuff coming out soon. Very exciting. I spent the day writing yesterday. Also, check out No Small Roles. At No Small Roles, roles spelled R-O-L-L-S, which is the Dungeons & Dragons podcast that I play Juna, a 200-year-old gnome in. Very fun. Also check out Open Book Theatre and Open Bar Theatre. Open Bar Theatre at We Are Open Bar. We're touring Love's Labour's Lost and As You Like It across Fuller's Pubs from the 12th of July to the 16th of September. So I'm in As You Like It, but both of the shows are going to be amazing. So yeah, that's the highlight reel.
Beautiful. So good.
Yeah.
Literally pandemic shmendemic. You are on it. Bloody love Gaskin and Healy. Oh my God. Cannot get enough
Thank
of
you.
Your Shag, Marry, Kill series. Fucking love it. So funny. Definitely please go and check them out. They're amazing. And I will be getting
Thank you.
Tickets for your shows, of course.
Okay, so if you want to follow us, if you haven't done already, you can find us. We are on Facebook, we are on Instagram, we are on Twitter. Instagram in particular is a very busy place for ourselves, as Emily likes to post many, many wonderful things that she finds. So come and check us out, especially over there. Please do hit the like and subscribe button wherever you happen to be listening to us. Maybe leave us a review, as it all helps raise the profile of the show. Make sure you tell your friends, spam your enemies, all that good stuff. We will be back with Chapter 9, The Four Guards. But until next time, good night.